God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. You have the ability to unmute. You can just say hello. Anybody? All right, just the rusted servants tonight. All right. Jill, would you read, would you mind reading the preamble if I put it on the screen?
Sure will.
Thank you.
I'm Jill, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jill.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. All righty. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to welcome Charlie C. from Camarillo, California, to tell his story. And after Charlie does that, somewhere around the top of the hour, we'll stop. We'll take a short break. We'll pass the seven tradition basket, maybe call for an announcements, things like that, and give Charlie a little bit of a break. And then we'll reconvene for the last half an hour of the meeting or the last 25 minutes or so and ask questions. And the questions that we ask are going to be questions that you submit. We don't have a list of questions in the can just waiting. So as questions occur to you, please, this is your meeting. Put them in the chat to the user questions, and then we'll ask them. Sound good? All right. I'm very excited to, I have not heard Charlie's story, and I can't wait. Thank you so much, Charlie, for coming to share with us tonight. I give you all Charlie.
Thank you, David, and thank you for asking me to be here. You've never heard me before, so you're in trouble. I'm alcoholic. I have no outside issues. I have a wandering talk. So if you're looking for someone who's really polished, you're perhaps at the wrong meeting. It's so good to see my friend Harmony, who I've known for decades, and my friend Barbara, and it's great to be here. It's still 4 o'clock in the afternoon here in California. So, it's pleasant and I'll ruin it. Somehow I just have a feeling, but I'll start from the beginning. I should probably qualify and say that I'm sober since the 11th of June of 1981, that I have a sponsor who's 54 years sober and lives in Oxnard named Bob R. And I've had two sponsors in the 40 years that I've been sober. The first sponsor, his name was Bill McD, and Bill is still doing well and thriving and sober. And living in Santa Monica. So here we are. And I've been active in Alcoholics Anonymous the entire time I've been sober as well. And that's helped because I'm not an active guy. I'm not one who volunteers for things. I'm usually the one where everybody takes one step backward and leaves me in front of the line as for volunteers. I don't like people. I kind of got over it for a while in the 90s, and then it just came back in the last few years. It's not you, you know, it's them. You know who they are. If you don't know who they are, you're probably one of them. But I think people are just a waste of carbon, and they're petty, and they're malicious, and they're devious, and they do rotten things that even chipmunks wouldn't do to each other. And there are very few things chipmunks won't do to each other, but people, I can't stand the human race, and yet I demand its approval all the time. which it will wear you out. It's like having an emotional slinky, you know, it just goes back and forth. Why do you, you know, get away from me? Why are you paying attention? Leave me alone. Whoa, where are you going? And that said back, endless back and forth of trying to make everybody happy and feel like I'm okay. And I have always been that way. Always. I'm an only child. I have no problem being alone. None. I'm completely okay with a chair and a book and a cup of coffee these days. And I went through school with nothing but my potential. I was a child of potential. I'm sure there are a couple of people in here who have a lot of potential that they still haven't engaged yet. But I was always in front of somebody in authority at school with my parents on both sides, because my dad had a fifth grade education and my mom had about a seventh grade education. They were both children of the Depression and they both had to work and they had to get out of school. And so when I was born and my parents had had three other tries besides me, my mom had three full-term pregnancies that died and they were all boys. And so when I was born, there was all I had to do was clear my throat and the house would get scrubbed down like a surgical station. And so when I kept getting brought in front of the principal or the counselor or the priest or whoever it was that was concerned about my well-being, because I wasn't a bad kid, but I get in there and they would say, you know, Charles has a lot of potential and we just don't understand why he doesn't use it. And my reaction was always the same. And that is, I know I've got potential. Clearly, you know, I've got potential because you're looking at it in a book. And now my parents know I've got potential and all God's chillen seem to know I've got potential. And I just want you to know that I will use my potential when I'm goddamn good and ready to use it. And not a second before then. When I do use my potential, I hope you've got sunglasses on, Skipper, because I'm going to light you up. But until then, until I decide to engage my potential, you might want to go wipe your concern for it on somebody else, because if you were such hot stuff, you wouldn't be a high school counselor, would you? I never said it in exactly those words. I usually said something like, well, I'll try harder. But I've always been what I like to think of as a quiet rebel. I'm rebellious as can be, but I just don't want to tell anybody. And so that's how I live my life. And I got out of high school with nothing but potential. And I got out of high school and right into the music industry as a clerk in a record store. And I was working there and some guys came in and asked me if I wanted to go to a party. And I had never been to a party before because, you know, as I understood it, there would be people there and that was just not going to work. So I said, I don't know. I didn't really want to go. These guys were trouble at my high school. They were tough dudes. And in those days. And I said, okay, I'll go. And then I got my best friend and he drove us to the party on that Saturday night. And it was at a big Victorian house in Santa Ana, California. And there were probably 250 kids in there and they were swinging from the rafters. Everything was going on in this house. They had the MC5 on the stereo. It was November of 1968 and I had just turned 18 and the place was jumping. And half the room was on acid and the other half was drunk. And they all believed they were having an experience with each other. And I stood there thinking, boy, did I make a mistake. I should never have agreed to come to this. This is the sorriest looking hive of ferret-faced little bastards I've ever seen in my life. And I just wanted to leave. And I'd only been there for 5 minutes, so it was unlikely my friend was going to want to leave. So I stood there against the wall, just grinding on, oh my God, I do not fit in with this crowd at all. If my father knows I'm here, he'll kill me. And then someone came by and handed me a can of malt liquor. And I'd never had a drink before in my life. And I had this can of malt liquor in those days when the cans were about, I don't know, there are a couple of you who are in your 60s here and they have the cans of malt liquor that were about this high. You know, I had to put them in like a 14-inch bag to drink them. And I got this can of malt liquor and thought, now, not only is my father going to kill me, but the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles is going to kill me because I made a promise when I was confirmed that I wasn't going to drink until I was 21 years old. And now I'm 18. I've got the evidence right here in this room full of Satan's children, and I'm doomed in here. But since no one else is going to offer me anything else to drink, I started drinking this can of malt liquor. And halfway through that can of malt liquor, it occurred to me that I'd been way too hard on you people. I began to feel, I don't want to oversell it, but when I drank, I became legend inside. I transformed. I felt good about myself. I felt good about you. I felt like my potential was fulfilling itself while I was standing there. I felt attractive. I never felt attractive before, but then it was like, ladies, my eyes are up here, and I was alive. I mean, I was percolating, and I couldn't believe it. I was interested in other people. All of my self-awareness and my self-involvement seemed to have disappeared. I don't know why or how, but it did. And I couldn't wait to drink again after that. I got sick that night. I wound up running. My friend wanted to leave at a certain point, and by that time, I was entrenched at this party. And I would remember coming out of a blackout, running alongside of his car, holding onto the door handle from the outside. He had an old Volkswagen, and I was throwing up all over myself, and I was just laughing my ass off because I had never experienced a change like that in my life. And that I believe that experience dooms somebody like you and me, because when you drink the first time and you hit it out of the park, as far as the way you feel inside and the way everything just is such a relief and so exciting and so much, it gave me a sense of anticipation about life that I never had before. Once you've done that, everything else is useless, really, to me. And also, and I had that template of that perfect time that I would lay over every time I ever took a drink, like, it'll work again this time. And all I could describe it as, and I've been talking about this for years, so it's nothing new to anybody who's heard this blather before, but when I drink, I don't get drunk. Other people mistake it for drunk, but I know that I'm not drunk as much as I am there. I am there in the moment. I am living in the moment. I am in the present. I have no worries about what happened yesterday and no fear of what's going to happen next. I am point man for the world. I feel great when I'm drinking. And you would think, and I might just caution new people, that the term "you would think" is the great tripwire of sobriety. You would think that having that experience with alcohol would be a good thing, really, if you are a person who feels hateful of the human race and isolated and upset with themselves and feels ugly and feels useless and doesn't know what they want in life. And all of a sudden we take a drink and all of a sudden our lives change and the world around us changes and we feel present for a change and hopeful for a change and joyful. You would think that would be a good thing. And I pondered that for a long time after I got sober. Why can't that be a good thing? If God really loves us, why can't he just give us good livers? Really, it's a simple request, really. If he's an almighty God and he loves us, come on, man, give us a liver that's going to last. But no, we wind up getting sick and we wind up sitting, beating our heads against the wall as to why doesn't this work anymore? Why can't I get there and stay there like I used to? And I realized that there is an illusion. I've never come out of a blackout and found all my bills paid on my desk, sitting in envelopes ready to get mailed. you know, but I've started drinking, worrying about money and angry at the people that are, you know, want my money, you know, they want their money back, but they want my money. And all that unexamined conflict with the world that I wasn't aware of, I just accepted it and reacted to it. And when you try to, and I was considered a nice guy, a nice person, but you cannot hold that kind of anger at the injustice of the world inside for too long before it starts leaking out in other areas, relationships, family, job, all those things, hope. I had a neighbor across the street from my house when I was living in a different place at the time, just in the last 10, 20 years. And her name was Lisa and her husband's name was Tom. And this has nothing to do with alcoholism per se, but Tom was one of those neighbors. He reminded me a lot of my father because he would, if you needed something fixed in your house, he would come over and fix it for you. If you needed a cabinet door fixed, he would come over and fix it because he was a set carpenter for the studios and he knew how to fix everything. And Tom got pancreatic cancer. And so and they had two children the same age as my children. And I went over one day and was talking to Lisa and I said, "Where's Tom?" And she said, he had to go to the hospital last night. And I said, what's going to happen? And she said, "Well, they're going to do a surgery on him today." And I said, "Are they going to be able to get the cancer?" And she said, "Oh no, they're not going in there to try to get the cancer. They're going in there to take out parts of his stomach and his intestines and his the area around the tumor to give the tumor space to grow so that he can get through the holidays without complete discomfort before he dies. And then he can be with the children for the holidays." And I don't mean to make anything trivialize his suffering because he was a wonderful human being and his family was very close. I was very close to his family. But is that not exactly what alcoholism does to people like you and me? I mean, we cut away perfectly good parts of our lives to allow it to grow. We cut away family. We cut away love. We cut away responsibility. We cut away dreams, you know, hope. We just don't. I just have to take a drink today. And that's how I drink. I drink because alcohol gives me the satisfaction of a job well done without having to do a damn thing. You know, when I drink, it says in our book that we're like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I'm sure many of us are. But when I drink, I'm like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Rogers. Because when I'm sober is when I want to get up on the tower with a bolt action rifle. It's when I'm drinking that I'm filled with joy and my insides match my expectations of the world. You know, the world, everything seems to be in balance when I'm drinking. And it's a solution for all of the things that I feel inside that I can't even touch. Because I don't even know they're in there. How do you know they're in there? You don't really. And if I had conflicts, I surely did, I would just build it's like painting a condemned house. You know, it looks better, but you're really not doing much to fix the problem. And I'm one of those people that, you know, I had a scaffold of lies and half truths and opinions around me with a big sign, like you see on the street in front of a big building that's being remodeled and it says "coming soon" on it. And that's how I live my whole life, is pretending that everything's going to happen soon. If you hang on to this star, you know, it's going to happen. And nothing ever did. Nothing ever did. I would rather drink than do anything. I would rather drink than go to work. I'd rather drink than go. I remember having dates where I would pass out before I would go out and they would call me the next day and say, "I thought we were going out last night." And I thought, "Oh man, that's terrible." And you kind of wish you had better I do have better communication with women, because I would say, "Why don't we just say, okay, let's just say, we're going to go out. We'll go out on Friday. And then neither of us show up. And we'll have the anticipation of a great time with none of the disappointment." What a world. And this is the way I was thinking when I was drinking. It's like trying to patch together a life that is all jerry-rigged. It's all jerry-rigged with reality, and alcohol makes it all work for me. And I tried taking drugs, and drugs got me high. And I don't want to be high. I want to be there. I want to be in that place where everything is going to work out in about 20 minutes, you know, where I can crush the grapes of life against the roof of my mouth and feel that cool juice come down, where I feel like all my emotions are on the surface and all the nerve endings are percolating on the end, and my creativity is alive, and I'm going to take this whole life and I'm going to grab it and I'm going to hold it and hump it, whatever I got to do with it to keep it. And I'm going to write all the experiences down, good or bad, and rock it into the stratosphere, and at the peak of my powers, explode and just shower the world with stars. You know, that's how I want to live. But tonight, I'm just going to have a couple of drinks to make it better. And that's how I drink. I have a boring drunkalog. I've never come out of a blackout yelling, call for backup. I've heard those stories. I've heard people coming out of blackouts going, okay, cut the red wire. And that's not my story. I've come out of blackouts with people saying stuff to me like, boy, I bet that hurt. And that's because I'm a clumsy alcoholic and I fall a lot. But I drank for the next 12 years and I got married, and I married a woman who had one major flaw in her life, and that was that she loved me. And I just couldn't understand. I was so immature and so unwilling to look at myself that everything seemed to be her problem. And eventually she couldn't take it anymore. You know, she wanted a divorce, and her brother was a great guy. And she had told me, you know, Bob is, he drinks a lot. And when he comes over to see us, don't give him any alcohol, because he goes to hospitals. He goes to he's been to a sanitarium for his drinking. And I thought, well, he couldn't be that bad, you know, and we just started living together. It's about 1975. So Bob came over one night to visit our new apartment, and I broke out a bottle of bourbon and we started drinking, and we were having a great time. We're listening to music and laughing and scratching and just having a really nice time. And I glance over and my wife is standing at the bedroom door giving me the international signal that you're not going to get a compliment. And I went over to see what the problem was and excused myself and went over, and she shut the bedroom door and said, you've got to stop giving Bob alcohol. Bob is alcoholic. And I said, Bob is no one more alcoholic than I am. The problem we have here is that you're a nag and you need to back it off, sister. And I strolled out of the bedroom, and she started sobbing in there, and we just turned the stereo up. And 2 weeks later, Bob was dead. Bob drowned going into, I believe it was Lake Castaic in Central California. And he went in for a swim in the afternoon. He'd been drinking and taking some drugs, and he didn't come out of the water. He was a handsome, young 25-year-old guy with a 5-year-old daughter. And he was dead. And no one talked about alcoholism then. No one talked about anybody's drinking. You know, it was just a terrible tragedy. And I mistreated, you know, I'm not a physically mistreating guy, but I was really mean to her, and she wanted a divorce. And I was really verbally mean to my mom. I mean, my dad died when I was 23, and my mom tried, you know, she tried to love me. I would always try to, you know, you don't have any power in the world. You're just feeling like a complete loser. And so the only person you want to bait is an old lady that can't argue back really well. And that's always, I'd always get her into a little, you know, tease her into a little debate and then be, you know, just unnecessarily mean. And it got worse and worse. And I had that part of my life that was shut down, and my marriage shut down, and my friendships, we get to AA sometimes, we think that I don't have any friends at all. Well, I got to AA and I had disconnected all my friendships. It's not that everybody left me. I just disconnected them because they weren't living up to this gauzy picture of what the world ought to be, you know? And the alcohol made it better, but now it wasn't working full time. It was working part of the time or a lot of the time and then very little of the time. And it was unpredictable. And my solutions were getting narrower. And my ex-wife had recommended that I go to therapy when we were about a year before we got divorced. And I was going to therapy. And I'll tell you something, therapy is great. And I'm not one to knock therapy. I think if you need therapy, you should go to therapy. But therapy, I believe, does not work for alcoholism at all, because the prerequisite for therapy to work is the truth. And if you're an alcoholic, you can do the math on that one. If you're in your first year of sobriety, we love you and we hope you stay. But I want to tell you something. You don't even have a whiff of the truth yet. And you'll get it and you're going to hate it, but it's going to make it better. And there, all of us around here are going to walk with you through it. So you don't have to feel like you're doing it all yourself. But I didn't feel like I had that then. And I kept going to therapy. And this was a wonderful therapist. She was a lovely woman. And she really helped me in a lot of ways. But she had a meditation retreat after I got a divorce. She was having this meditation retreat in Montecito, which is just up the coast from me. And I was at a place called Casa de Maria, which is run by the nuns. And I agreed to go up there, and I'd been drunk the night before. I drive up there on the 11th of June of 1981, and I get up there and I'm thinking, I can't wait to get a drink. It's like 4 o'clock when I get there. Everybody's showing up, the cars are pulling in, you know, into the parking lot, and it's stacked parking. So I'm in the middle of it because I got there first. And she said, "What, would you like something to drink?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like a glass of wine." And she laughed. She laughed and she said, "Oh, we don't have any wine here." And I said, I didn't say it, I thought it. You've got to be kidding me. This is a Catholic retreat center. You've got to have some unconsecrated blood of Christ around here somewhere. You know, this, it's some, you know, anything. And she said, how about some herb tea? And I thought, oh, geez, you know, when you start to have the first pangs of detoxing, which it's sometimes it's just because you're like 3 hours late getting your drink going for the day. Those first few minutes are really, you just feel, you know, irritable. And it's not something that rose hips is going to help, really. And so I went along with it, and we had a guided meditation the next morning where we walked through a field. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced a guided meditation, but you're with the therapist and they're playing, in her case, she's playing pan flute music, you know, and we had our shoes off and we were walking. Now, everybody else was doing this. I was laying on the floor thinking, oh, come on. Oh, and I could feel the shag carpet coming through my shirt. And was just uncomfortable. And she was saying, okay, now you're going to walk up to, trust me, I'd been peeing blood for about 4 months before this. And I was really physically sick and was about to lose my job, I'm sure of it. And they liked me where I worked, but they couldn't take any more of me. And there I was at this meditation retreat trying to get better. And my marriage had fallen apart. My job is tedious. I wanted to be a writer, and I got a job in a bookstore just to be, you know how that's going to work. If you want to be a writer, you get a job in a bookstore and it rubs off on you and you become a writer, right? And so I'm laying on the floor and she says, okay, we're walking through a field and we come up to a waterfall. And the waterfall, you can stand in front of it and you feel the mist of it as it hits the ground below you. And you step into the waterfall and the water turns red and it washes away your anger. And then the water turns green and it washes away your jealousy. And it turns blue and it washes away all your sadness. And we went through the whole Sherwin-Williams catalog with this waterfall. And I was like, now it's turning Scotch pine to wash away whatever your brogue, whatever it is. And I'm standing there just dying, thinking this is the stupidest exercise I have ever been in. And she says, and now you step back out of the water and you can see through to the other side of the waterfall. And as you look on the other side of the waterfall, you will see where you are going to be 5 years from today. And for a moment, I was in that moment. And I looked through that damn waterfall, and all I saw was myself hanging by my neck from my bathrobe belt in my mother's bathroom, hanging from the back of the door, dead. That's what I saw. Other people probably saw grandchildren and careers and colleges and love. And I saw myself dead on the back of my mom's bathroom door with my bathrobe belt. And then she said, then it was the end of the meditation, the guided meditation. And she said, now I want you to go out on the grounds, which were beautiful grounds up there. And she said, I want you to walk around for the next 5 hours. And I want you to think about how you can get to that place in the next 5 years. I thought, oh, this is really not going to go well. And I went out there on the grounds. And within about 20 minutes, I found a tree to sit under. And I thought, I really want to die. I really want to die, but I don't want any drama. I'm not going to write a list of all the people who are going to be grieving the hardest. I'm not going to write a list of songs I want played at my funeral. I just want to be dead. I want my life to be taken from me because I don't fit here. It doesn't work for me here. And I don't know why, because I had good parents and a good community and a good religious upbringing. And I've had joy and I've had people who loved me. And I just don't know why I don't fit in. I would rather drink and burn it all down than to be around people and experience that discomfort and disappointment I feel about life in general that alcohol seems to save me from. It makes all the disappointment go away. Clancy used to say, it makes all of them smaller and less threatening. And I thought, boy, I understand that. And I just want that. And now I can't have it. And I wish I could just hang myself here in this grounds. And I don't mean for it to be a drama. I just want to die. And at the moment that I felt that and experienced that feeling of being completely given up on life, I felt completely loved inside. Throughout, every inch of me felt like I was loved. And I felt, it's sort of a voice, but it's not really a voice. And it sounds like a hallucination, but it's not really. But I felt this sensation of, you are everything that you're afraid of, and I still love you. I didn't know where that came from. I just felt completely loved for about 30 seconds. It only lasted about 30 seconds and then it went away. And I sat there and sobbed for a long time. I don't know how long it was. Could have been hours. And I went back to the meditation retreat and I didn't interact with anybody that night. And I didn't interact with anybody the next day. And I just drove home. And I haven't had a drink or any drugs or anything since then. And it's not that I didn't think about it the first 2 years I was sober. It wasn't that I didn't miss it, but I just didn't do it. And I got to a meeting about a week, about 4 days after I'd stopped drinking. My sister-in-law, the widow of Bob and the mother of his child, she called me and my mother-in-law called actually, and she said that Debbie had just gotten out of a detox and she wondered if I would go pick her up and take her to an AA meeting. And I thought, well, you know, I've been sober for 4 days. I'm twitching. I'm having imaginary voices in the backseat of my car talking to me. I've got those gnats that seem to gather in your peripheral vision when you're first getting sober and you go to look at them and they're gone. And then you go back to talking to somebody and they're back again. So all you can do is when you talk to people is brush them away and watch the expression on their face as they try to figure out why you're waving your hand as if you're brushing something away that's not really there. I forgot how to walk my second day of not drinking. I had to sit on a planter and watch other people walk before I took the courage to get up and try it again. And somebody told me, you know, hey, you go here and you go, I couldn't walk one day and I don't understand what happened. And they said, well, that's Jake leg. That's common for when you're detoxing. If you're an alcoholic, you forget, you can't walk. Your legs won't work for you. You hear things, you're detoxing. You're having a little bit of delirium and you don't know what it is. And here I'm thinking, if I quit drinking, my life will get better. And just the opposite happened. I quit drinking and things started, it became like Alice in Wonderland time. It was terrifying. A bird would fly by like a seagull on my way to work and I would have to pull over and cry. This is not good behavior. And certainly you can't tell people on a loading dock where you're working why you're late that morning because you had to pull over and cry because a bird had flown by. But that's what I was going through. And you're concealing all these things and you're not going to tell anybody. And I sure wasn't going to tell I was living at my mom's house because that's where all male alcoholics wind up eventually. And my mom had married another guy. They were living somewhere else. And I was way behind on paying her mortgage on the house and was going to lose it, but I couldn't tell her. You know, and all that stuff. You got all those secrets and all those things you're holding in and hiding. And now I'm going to pick up Debbie, though, and I'm going to take her to an AA meeting. And I took her to this meeting, and we pull up in front. And I said, what time do you want me to come back and get you? It was in Tustin, California, down in Orange County. And she said, well, why don't you come in the meeting with me? And I said, because I'm not an alcoholic. You know, so I'm whipping away these imaginary gnats. And she said, that's okay. You don't have to be an alcoholic. It's an open meeting. And guests are welcome. And since you said you just quit drinking this week, maybe you'll hear something that'll help you. And I couldn't argue with her. That was an airtight response. And she wasn't arguing. She was just making a suggestion. And I gave in. I think that might've been my first surrender, was that I went into the meeting with Debbie rather than coming back and picking her up. And I didn't like it at the meeting. They got me a big book. Charlie, you want a big book? And I thought, oh God, you know, I work in a bookstore. How big a book is it? Does it have a title, for instance? Maybe anything that would identify it other than its size? That's what I was thinking. I wouldn't say it, but I was thinking it. Every time anybody said something, there were so many, I don't know about if you're new, I'm with you on this. There's so many people that have that can-do spirit. Oh, we're all going to stay sober together. This is a can-do program. We're going to hang with our higher power. I couldn't stand it. I thought I'm going to get to the bottom of this because I had a degree in journalism. It was in a drawer somewhere at home, but I had one. And I'm going to get to the bottom of all this phony, just a bunch of phonies. All this talk about I'm alcoholic, but my life is much better. And my best day, my worst day drinking sober is better than my best day drinking. I thought, you've got to be kidding. You must be, you're lying. And I didn't say it. I just would, smile. I'm in the back of the room. Now, when I went to my first AA meeting, I did not look like I look now. I'm almost 71 years old now. And then I was 30. And I had long hair and I had a really fulsome mustache I had my sunglasses on, of course, because sometimes it gets really bright in AA meetings at night. And I had my Deerstalker Sherlock Holmes hat on. I had a tweed jacket and a wool sweater vest. And it was about, I think that it was a heat wave that year. It was about 111 outside. And I've got my Levi's and boots on and I'm standing in the back of the meeting, not looking at anybody, just rocking on my heels and getting really irritated when people would come up and go, are you new? And they'd hand me their card. The guys would hand me their phone number or card or something. I thought, you know, I'm not new. I got 4 days. And then they would laugh, you know, and I took that personally. Like, what are you laughing for? That was the hardest 4 goddamn days of my life. You know, and you chuckle about it. Well, they were only laughing because they understood what it was like to have 4 days of sobriety, and they remembered, and they were just hoping, they were just wishing for the best for me, honestly. And so I got a big book. I was forced to go up to the literature lady, who looked like something out of a nightmare. She looked like she'd run through a set of drapes before she came into the meeting. She had all the chiffon stuff, and she was about 6 feet tall and had a big starched cowboy hat on. And she had white hair that was in this flip, and it was terrifying. And she said, Debbie brought me up to her and said, Charlie needs a big book. And my natural instinct was to say, Charlie doesn't need a big book, but I'm just being polite. But there I was. And she said, well, here's a book for you. Here, take the book. And I said, how much is this? And she says, $5. And I reached in my pocket and I had $3. And not only was it $3, it was a really sad looking $3. It looked like these dollar bills had just given up their will to live. And I'm looking at them in my hand and I said, you know, I'm going to come back next week and get your book. Excuse me. And she said, wait a minute. No. This is the second Sunday of the month. It's only $2 tonight. You know, and I said, oh, she said, yeah, it's $2 tonight. Look, I'll just take your $2. Okay. And you've got another dollar in your hand. When the basket comes around, you take that other dollar and you drop it in the basket because nobody around here stays sober on somebody else's dime, hon. Okay. So I got the book and I felt terrible because now I had debt with every credit card company in North America. And now I'm into AA for $3, which is so depressing. And I got your book. And then when the basket went by, I didn't know where she was in the meeting. So I wasn't going to let her, you know, sneak up on me. So I kind of waved the dollar in the air and dropped it in the basket and watched it flutter in. So it was a big show, you know, for her. And I left that meeting and I went home and I didn't take a drink. I had a bottle of bourbon at home, but I didn't drink it. And I went to the next Sunday meeting because AA meets on Sundays, as I understood it. And there we were, Debbie and me, and Debbie was going to take a chip. She said, you got to come see me take a chip. And she and all the other inmates from the detox were there, like 30 people there. That's when they were cranking them out. Like it was like it was crazy. It was like making Doritos in detoxes. And they're cranking people out. And she's in there with her class. You know, they've all still got their wristband on, which to me, it just made me go, oh, God, I felt terrible because I didn't have a wristband. That should be the 21st question on that yellow card, because I felt less than because I didn't have a hospital wristband from the detox she was in. And so Debbie got a chip and a hug. She said, if you stay sober for 30 days, Charlie, they give you a chip and a hug. And I thought, oh, a chip and a hug, both. Whoa, you know, and imagine that. And I thought, you know, if you maybe paperclipped a 20 on the back of the chip, then I'd be more inclined to stay sober and come take it. But I can't, you know, I came back the next week because at 32 days she got drunk again and I was still there. And I felt like I'd been betrayed, like someone had abandoned me in Alcoholics Anonymous with all these strangers, and people were just kind to me. They said, don't worry about it. Go over and be a greeter, you know? And they made me a greeter. I was the worst greeter you can ever imagine in an AA meeting. It's like a mortician in your hospital room. That's what I look like. And hi, welcome to AA. Now run for your life. These people are crazy. And I went home that night. I heard Chuck Chamberlain speak that night. And Chuck, if any of you ever met Chuck Chamberlain, he lit up a room. This guy did. And he would thank the last person in line with the same enthusiasm that he thanked the first person in line. And he was a ray of positivity and joy when he would come into a meeting and give his talk. And I didn't understand a word he said. And people said, well, go up and thank him. And I thought, why do I want to thank him? I didn't say that, but they said, go thank him. He gave up his whole evening to come here and talk to you. The least you can do is say thank you. And so I thought, okay, that makes sense. So I went up and thanked him. I was the last person in line. And he grabbed me by the shoulders and he looked at me and he said, how long are you sober, boy? And I said, 20 days. And he said, oh, God, I love you. And he threw his arms around me and he kissed me. And that is where I think I caught alcoholism, because Chuck apparently was a carrier, because I came back the next week and people kept saying, do you have a sponsor? And I thought, what do I need a sponsor for? And, well, you need a sponsor. A sponsor will walk you through the big book. And I thought, I've looked at this book and I don't know that I don't want to sound pretentious, but I've parsed some of the finest poetry in the English language. I can tell you where the caesura falls in a line of poetry. I can tell you what the meter is. I can tell you what the rhyme structure is, the figurative language, the emotive language in it. I can't tell you how I'm feeling right at this moment, but I can tell you all those things about what Shakespeare felt in 1620 or wherever it was. And I don't know that I need somebody to help me unpack the jaywalker analogy, you know, in your big book. I don't even know. I don't know that I need someone to explain to me the deeper meaning of "Gee, Ma, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing," or tell me why I should give a crap about Mr. Brown, really. And if you don't know who Mr. Brown is, shame on you. But I didn't want to get a sponsor, but I got a sponsor eventually because I was recommended by another speaker who came there to come to meetings closer to where I worked. And he would meet me there. And I got a sponsor at that meeting, not because I had any virtue or because I wanted to get better. I got a sponsor so you would shut up and leave me alone and quit asking me if I have a sponsor. And I want you to know too, if you're new, you don't have to be sincere to stay sober. Sincerity is not a prerequisite for sobriety. You just have to do certain things. If sincerity was a prerequisite, we would all be drunk. Even the Al-Anons that come to these meetings would be drunk because sincerity means nothing. It's only what you do around here. It's not how you feel. Alcohol. People talk about, I hear people all the time talk about, oh, I've got alcoholic emotions. There's no such thing as an alcoholic emotion. There hasn't been a new emotion in the human species since species were made. We have different kinds of emotions. I mean, our emotional reaction to things is sometimes, in three areas, we have emotional abnormality. One is timing. My timing with my emotions is usually unfortunate. Intensity is usually inappropriate for the moment. And the duration usually goes on longer or shorter than it should, really. But other than that, my emotions are all the same as everybody else's. And I finally got a sponsor, and he was a big, tall guy named Bill McDee, and Bill was just, it was great. He was very helpful to me for 26 years. That man, I can't tell you how much I love this guy. I love both my sponsors. I love my current sponsor, Bob, who is he's like a reservoir of AA experience and good nature and good humor. And he likes to be my friend, but he knows where the line is between a friend and a sponsor. And he knows how to pull the rug out from under me when I need it. And Bill was the same way. And he walked me through everything. He walked me through a divorce, through the death of my stepfather, through my mom's illnesses. And when I got married at 17 years sober and had two children starting at age 50. And, not recommended, really, but it's okay. I had enough energy where I could throw them in the air. You know, you want to get them, so you can throw them in the air and catch them. I didn't want to reach that age where it was either just one or the other. You know, just throw them in the air and let somebody else step in and grab them. I'm a little tired. But, he walked me through that. He was the first one at the hospital door when my son was born and wanted to come in and say hi and ask what he could do to help, you know. And I've had that experience in AA. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but I started going to a different home group and I got that sponsor there and I started to do things that he asked me to do. And he asked me to do certain things: call him every day, get to a meeting every day, treat the meeting like get a commitment at the meeting and treat it like a job, which means show up on time and do what you're supposed to do every week. I want you to shake hands with everybody at the meeting and ask them their name and look them in the eye when you ask them. Do not look at their shoes. Look them in the eye. I want you to get phone numbers from 10 men at the meeting. And then I want you to call one of those guys the next day and just tell them you're thinking about them. That's all you got to say. You don't have to get engaged in conversation. If you ask them how they are, they'll give you 10 minutes with no problem. So just call and check in with them and call me. And I want you to talk to a higher power. I want you to talk to a power that's greater than you are. Get on your knees every day in the morning and the evening and talk to this power. And I thought, listen, I'm a Catholic and I have a real problem with the Catholic Church because when I was a little kid, and my mom was having her last baby. I was the third of the four boys. And when she was having this baby, I got sent down to the Klein's house. And Mr. and Mrs. Klein were nice enough to let me stay there while my mom went to the hospital. And I was 8 years old. And I was in that house, and I remember this vividly. I was laying in Chris Klein's bed. He was sleeping in the floor somewhere. And I remember laying there running a little figure eight on the wall with my finger and saying, God, please help my mom and let this baby be okay. Please let this baby be okay. And the next day, Mrs. Klein said, it's time, you can go home today, but don't talk to your mom about babies. Just don't get in a conversation. And I went home, and there were cards stuck in the screen door, and no one told me what happened. You know, the baby had died at birth, again, like all the others. She had what was called an RH blood condition at the time, and they had no treatment for it. And so if you had RH blood and you had a child, the chances are the child would die, or had a good chance of it dying. And I was angry, because I thought, if this God does not even listen to the prayers of an eight-year-old, what good is it? Who cares? He's probably up there with all these pontificating, nice, good people that keep, you know, they all keep their gloves in their glove box and everything's in its right place. And he's up in the penthouse with them. And it's really unlikely that somebody like me, with my record, is ever going to get up the stairs to that penthouse and spend time with this higher power. Why bother? But I did what Bill said, because I didn't have any other options and I was afraid of going back out. So I did what he said, and I called people and I did everything that was asked of me in AA, and went to my meetings and went for coffee afterward, and went to a book study and went to discussion meetings and went to speaker meetings and went to a men's stag and did everything that was asked, helped people move, and sat up till midnight at watches. We have watches in our group where when someone turns a year sober, we sit up with them the night before till it reaches midnight, and then we sing happy birthday to them at midnight and we all leave. You know, that's just the way it is. And I did all that stuff, and I went to Clancy's Yard and played softball. And I'll tell you something, my sports career is ahead of me. At the time, I just did not have any talent with a softball, I didn't even have a glove. I didn't even have a glove. I'm left-handed, and I would borrow somebody's glove and have to put it on my right, you know, on my left hand. And then I had to take it off to put it under my arm to throw the ball. And I throw like a, you know, I just don't have a throwing technique. And I was a bad batter, and I was just terrible. And nobody ever threw me off their team. They all were, you know, you could tell there was some concern, because we never won when I was on their team. But one day I got up to bat. I remember that the pitcher did everything except walk up and hold the ball in front of me. You know, I'd let good pitches fly by, and he'd yell, "Come on, Charlie, what are you waiting for? That's a good pitch." And I thought, I don't know a good pitch from a bad pitch. I'm just afraid to hit it. And then finally I took a swing and I hit it, and I felt that bat crack against that ball, and all these alcoholics are standing there, and I stood there staring, and they yelled, "Run!" And I thought, like, oh, and I threw the bat down and took off. And as the ball rolled toward the pitcher, I'm running as fast as I can to get to first base. And the pitcher picked up the ball, and I tripped halfway between home and first base and fell. And I'm laying on my back while the coach of our team, the captain of our team, is yelling at me to get up. And I felt like for a moment there, I just felt like I knew what a bug felt like when it's on its back, helplessly trying to roll over to get on its feet. But I finally got on my feet, and I thought he would have thrown me out. And the pitcher was still holding the ball. And he goes, "Go." And I started running for first base, and then he threw the ball, and the guy tagged me out. And everybody cheered. And I realized later on they were clapping because, A, I got a hit. I tried to get a hit. And, B, the guy gave me the dignity of getting up and going to first base without getting thrown out and discarded. Like, oh, yeah, he wasn't going to get it anyway. He allowed me the dignity of running to that plate, and I appreciated that. And I felt better after that. And I did that for 3 years. Every weekend, I would go there and humiliate myself in front of my peers to play ball. And it made me feel better. But nothing changed my first year. I was 8 months sober and nothing happened. And I thought, this program doesn't work because I haven't had a drink in 8 months and nothing happens. You know, I don't know, AA doesn't work. And I asked my sponsor, and he said very nicely, he didn't understand why I would ask him that, because he wasn't psychic. And he said, just stick around. You'll have, because I heard everybody talking about their spiritual experience. Oh, I'm having a spiritual experience, a big spiritual experience. Everybody's having a spiritual experience. Hey, everybody's just walking with God, you know, God's BFF. Everything was great. And I wasn't having any of that. I was just going to the meetings and folding sound cords for the anal retentive sound guy on Saturday night, cleaning coffee pots, mopping the floor, giving newcomers rides, doing all that crap stuff. And AA was not working because I didn't get any spiritual juice out of this. And so he sat me down one day and he said, I asked him when I was going to have this awakening. And he said, are you going to meet? I said, well, how come we're not doing the steps? Because I heard of other people in different groups that are going through the steps, and they're doing the steps. They're doing the step. They're working them. They're getting like cross training clothes and, you know, spot me. I'm going to do three. Why aren't we doing that? You never walked me through the book. And he said, you can read, can't you? And I said, yeah. And you're going to a book study, right? Said, yeah. And he said, what do you want from me? I'm not going to walk through it with you like your child. Go to the book study. Don't read it on your own because you'll just criticize it. Just go to the book study and listen to other alcoholics read it. I did that. He said, you're going to your meetings because I see you there every night, and I see you doing your commitments, and no one's ever complained about you, and you go out for coffee with us. And I know you're praying because I wait on the phone for you to pray in the morning. He would call me at 5:30 in the morning. Charlie, you up? Yeah, have you prayed yet? Nope. Okay, do it. I'll wait. And he would wait for me. This went on for a couple of weeks. He would wait for me to pray till I got used to doing it, to pray to a God that I didn't believe in. So I just pray to the bedspread, you know, and not tell him. And he said, you're doing all this stuff, right? And I said, yes. And he said, what part of the first three steps do you think you're not doing? Do you love doing all this stuff? And I said, no. And he goes, what do you do when you don't want to do it? And I said, well, I do it anyway. And he said, how do you feel afterward? And I said, I feel better. And he said, do you want to go play softball every Saturday? No, I don't even understand what softball has to do with spirituality at all. Quite honestly, I don't know now either. But he said, but you go there and you're not a ball player, are you? And I said, not at all. And he said, but how do you feel when you leave? And I said, I feel better, partly because it's over. And the other part, because I had a really hard, sweaty day yelling at guys and doing all the stuff we do and getting to know people outside of meetings. And he said, so you do what you don't really want to do, but you do it anyway to be useful to other people and be useful to a power that's bigger than you are. And I said, I guess so. And he said, what part of the first three steps do you think you're not doing? Because this program is way more than just ritual. It's not trying to feel good about feeling good. It's about doing things to be useful to a power bigger than you are, even when it feels really awkward and stupid and just uncomfortable, and you do it anyway, and you find out how to be of service to somebody else besides yourself. You know, that's what the steps are about. They're not theoretical. They're not meant, you know, the big book is not meant to be a Bible. It's not a Bible. It's just a guidebook for people. I know people I've known people through the years who knew that book backward and forward, who died drunk because they didn't know how to take it out on the road for a drive, you know. And all I have been able to use it for, because I have memory problems from drinking. I can't remember the poetry I studied when I was a kid or when I was a teacher. And I can't remember passages of the big book, but I know the big book inside and out, but I just can't relate it. I can't quote it to everybody, but you don't have to quote it. You just have to do it. And I found some great comfort in that. And 2 weeks later, when I was eight and a half months sober, I was at my Sunday night meeting and I was mopping the floor as I did for the previous 8 months. And I paused mopping and I looked at the people standing in line to thank the speaker. And it occurred to me, in here and not up here, it occurred to me that I knew every single one of you by your name, and I liked you. How does that happen? I didn't want to be anywhere else in the whole world except standing at that in that meeting place holding that mop and just feeling what I was feeling at the time, because I felt joy and I felt what was really love for somebody else. And I went home and I called Bill and told him what happened. And he said, you had a moment of grace. Cherish it. And I carried that through. I've carried that with me for the last 40 years. Not that moment. I've had many more moments since then. I've been able to sponsor people. I've been able to have children. I've been able to raise children on my own when my former wife was not equipped to do that. I had custody of my children when they were 5 and 6 years old, and raised them. And I'm in the middle of it. Yeah, you know, I'm not in the middle of it. I've just got a divorce in the last year. And, you know, these things, you can't stop an alcoholic when they've got friends and they've got a program. You really can't do it. And Alcoholics Anonymous has sustained me through this time. And it's allowed me to not have any rancor about it. A little, not nothing serious. I get resentments, but I don't hold them. You know, it's all right if you have if you get resentments, that's natural. You just can't hang on to them. You got to let them go. And my life has been remarkable since I've been sober. I've had 4 turns of career. I've been able to make amends to the Catholic Church and to the IRS at the same time. And my life has gotten better. I wouldn't change it for anything. And so I guess I'll stop there. That's too long. So I hope you have a great weekend, and thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, Charlie, thank you so much. Thank you. Everybody has the ability to unmute momentarily and thank Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charlie.
Awesome.
That was fantastic, sir. Thank you.
Very
inspiring. Good talk.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you for your service, Charlie.
Thanks.
Thank you, Charlie, for your service.
Thank you.
We love you, Charlie.
Oh, you don't know me.
yeah, we do. All right, I'm gonna take the meeting back. We'll give Charlie a break here. We'll do a little bit of business. And I want to encourage everybody again, second call for questions. Please send your questions to the user questions in the chat. So let's see, where are we? I'm going to put a link out here. Once again, the seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Anybody? While you're thinking that over, I got a couple. Let's see, let me share my screen real quick. Simple Actions group, we have tomorrow night, we have a supper and a speaker. Cleo D from Baltimore is gonna come share tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. That's in the regular Simple Actions meeting slot. It is our plan for this to be the last meeting on Zoom, this Monday night meeting on Zoom. We will resume the following week, probably at First Pres, maybe at Ghent United Methodist Church, but we'll let you know about that. So that's happening tomorrow night. Please come. All are welcome, but that's happening on Zoom. And then a week from tonight, it is also our plan to abandon this wonderful Sunday night meeting for the last 75 weeks we've done. And the first person who, I know, Perry, the first person who kicked us off 75 weeks ago is going to cap it next week. We've got Don Major from Louisville, Kentucky. He's going to come and be with us next week. And maybe that'll be the last Zoom meeting for a while. Anyway, that's the plan. Anybody else think of an announcement? All righty then. I hope you guys are sending your questions in. I haven't looked. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All righty, time to see the questions. All right, so far there's only one question. Charlie, I wish you'd have developed a sense of humor over the last 40 years. you had me rolling. The first question that we have up here is, how do you avoid drifting into worry, remorse, and morbid reflection?
Wow. I often do that. So it's not like I don't drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Those are on my list of things to do today. What it is that I have, you know, we're all given a set of tools and we're taught how to use them when we're new, but we use them all the time, all the way, every day in our sobriety. And worry, remorse, and morbid reflection are things that, you know, first of all, you have to have a sense of humor about yourself and you have to know when you are in that morbid reflection. And I find that writing about it helps. I haven't done that recently, but I know that it has helped. I also find great relief in calling somebody else and finding out how they're doing. That's been my saving grace for 40 years is when I'm feeling weird, I called a guy today. I was feeling that I overslept today. I don't go to bed till like 4 a.m. usually. So I slept till about 11 today. I woke up feeling cranky. You know, my mom used to call it owly. You just don't get owly. So I was owly this morning and I thought I'm going to call my friend Joe because he fell down getting out of his car the other day and twisted his ankle and let's see how he's doing. So I called him because I was feeling bad about myself, but I don't have to tell him that and say, hey, Joe, I'm just calling because I'm feeling bad about myself. I wonder how you're doing. I just call him to see how he is, you know? And after we got done talking, I felt better. I didn't feel alone. And I said earlier that I have no problem being alone. But when they talk about loneliness in AA and for the loneliness of alcoholics, I believe, and this is my opinion only, that what they're talking about is that sense that I have all this remorse, this regret, this anger, the seething resentment, all these things that I carry around with me all the time, and I can't tell anybody about it. And that makes me feel lonelier than anything in the world. It's like I'm sitting on all these things, and I feel like there's no safe place to take them. And what happened in AA after doing the steps for a while is that I found this out after my first meeting, but I didn't realize it till a couple of months later, that when I was in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, even though I knew nobody there really, I was safe. I knew nothing bad was gonna happen to me. If I was sitting between Dave and Harmony in a meeting and I didn't know either of them, I could get the vibe from them unconsciously that they meant me no harm and that they were good people and they wanted to help. Even though we may have nothing in common and we have nothing superficially in common, we have one thing that holds us together, and that is that we understand what's at stake from taking a drink. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous has a primary purpose, because if we don't follow our primary purpose, then we're just a bunch of nice people talking about stuff. But if we all know that if I know that Dave and I have the same risk of drinking because of the way we feel and react to things in the world. And I don't want to drink. I will call him and tell him, even though I know nothing about his background or his family or his job or whatever, I'll call him because I know him, because he understands me, because we both are talking about the same thing. And I find that when I drift into worry, remorse, and morbid reflection, I am setting myself up to find a solution for it that might not be the best solution for me. So I have to turn to other people, and I have to call them, or I have to occupy myself in something positive and be useful to people rather than sit and ponder my own sad state. So that would be my answer. I know that's a little long, but.
Oh, it's fine. Thank you. I was just fascinated by your story, Charlie, too, because the way you describe drinking and almost as a spiritual experience, I share that. And it sounded like you almost kind of sort of accidentally got sober, you know, all these coincidences and ending up in AA with your friend and then ending up in a group and getting busy. I'm also wondering when the turn kind of came, or it sounded like around that 8-month mark, you know, is there something else to do? And I'm imagining that you might have gotten into an inventory after that, and wondering how that first inventory went and fifth step, and how did that go for you?
I did. You're right. I went and I got assigned my inventory at about 9 months. I would recommend to the guys I sponsor several guys, and I recommend to them with the guys they sponsor that they give them some months to do the stuff so they can actually feel like they're doing Alcoholics Anonymous before they get the inventory direction. I was given what was called the 7-question inventory back in 1981. It's one that Clancy came up with that was, it asks you 7 questions about your life and you write about it. And it gets out your resentments. It gets out your, not only all of your negative stuff, like the 4-column one, which is another great inventory technique method, but it also there's a question about what do you want to bring back to AA, what goodness do you want to use in your life to make it useful to other people, you know, which isn't what's in the book inventory. And so I did that one. I read it to Bill. I unburdened every guilty thing I had to give. I mean, I didn't hold anything back. I was ashamed when I read that inventory. I just felt scared. And we drove up the coast. He said, bring a flashlight and bring your inventory. And it was in an envelope, like a big manila envelope, because I wrote on everything. I wrote on napkins, and I would write on a matchbook cover if something came to mind, or I would write on a piece of paper, and I stuffed it in there. And he said, just start reading and don't pick any order. Just take what's on the top and read it. And the thing that happened, I got up like 4 down, and I realized there was something that I just did not want to tell another human being. I just could not tell another human being this. And so as he was driving, I surreptitiously fumbled with the papers and slipped it in and started reading the next thing. And he said, go back to that page you just dealt to the bottom of the deck. I thought, how does he know this stuff? You know, and I read him that. And he said, okay, now go on. He didn't even react to it. And he talked to me about his inventory. When we got done, we drove for about 2 hours up the coast and 2 hours back. And we went to a meeting. We pulled in the parking lot of our Thursday night meeting and walked in. Nobody said a word, you know. And I felt somehow unburdened at that point. And I felt like, well, this must be it, because I've told him every sleazy little thing I've ever done. Now there's another person that knows it. And no one can use that against me, because it's all out there. There are no secrets here. I'm an open book, and I want my life to be an open book. I don't want to have anything I've got to dodge around or build a pearl of lies around, some little imperfection. So it was very helpful. And then we went out for coffee afterward, and we were sitting at the table with about 16 people, and Bill tapped the side of his glass with his spoon and said, announcement, Charlie did his fifth step tonight. And everybody burst into applause at the table. And then Bill said, and if any of you want to hear parts of it, I have it in my car. So come on out. So, and we got a laugh out of it. And I've just been moving forward ever since then, you know.
So. How did he get you started on the amends trail?
I did that based on what other people were talking about. I just started making amends to the, I use my inventory for my amends list. I mean, for heaven's sake, don't do like what they used to do in the, there's a point at the, in the early 90s when people were burning their inventories as part of a ritual. After they would read it to their sponsor, they would burn it so that all of that part of them is dead and gone and it's in the wind. Well, you just burned up your 8-step list right there. You do the 8th and 9th step first, then you can burn it later, but get all that stuff on a list, you know, which I did. And I started making amends to people, and some were very easy. Some were just a phone call. Some were a phone call and a check. Others were an in-person. I had to make amends to my mom face-to-face, and it didn't go well. It did, you know, we hear all these heroic inventory, these heroic night step stories about how the, you know, the CEO forgave you and gave you a job, $100,000 a year job because you're so honest. My mom, I started to tell her about, you know, make amends to her. And she said, she interrupted me and said, but your dad and I tried to be good parents to you. And I realized this is not going the way it's supposed to go. I'm not getting it right. And I said, I finally cut it off. You know, your mind's going abort, abort, abort. And so I stopped it and started acting like a good son for her, which was better than apologizing. And, you know, sometimes AA is just a lot of talk. You'll know that because you won't feel quite right with a talk amends. But when you go back in there, and I had to pay her money back, I had to go to her house. I cleaned her house for her religiously. In fact, when she got older, she was living farther away than I, and I was married and had two kids. And I said, you know, I called somebody and said, would you come and clean my mom's house for me? And I'll pay for it. So I had a house cleaner coming over to clean her house for her. And I got over there one Saturday about 3 weeks later, and the house was, or this is 3 weeks after the person had come, and they'd been there for 6 or 7 months. And the house was a mess. And I said, why aren't these people cleaning these kinds of things up? And she said, oh, I don't know. And I said, well, I'm going to call them and find out. So I called them up and they said, well, your mom told us not to come anymore. She said that you'd do a better job and that she wanted you to do it. She was trying to get me to come back and clean her house for her. So I, you know, I did that. It was fine with me. You know, I just had to be a good son. And I think I satisfied that because my mom and I loved each other. When she died, I was, you know, I saw her the night before she died. And I thought, I never thought we would have that kind of relationship where we understood that there was love there and devotion there. And it was perfect. You know, it was just perfect. I don't have any regrets about that.
Thank you.
The IRS. It's people, I'll tell you, there's people at the IRS, and if you owe the IRS money and you're afraid, because you should be, because they're the IRS. But I called them up. I was told by a guy who was helping me with my 9-step. In my group, we have a 9-step, like they call it a class, like an amends class, where you sit down with somebody and you write out everything you've got to pay and all that stuff. And so I went, I called the IRS and I got a guy answered the phone. He said, this is Tony. I said, Tony? You know, I thought this was the Internal Revenue Service. Please hold. It wasn't. It was a guy named Tony. I said, is this the Internal Revenue Service? And he said, yeah. And so I told him I hadn't paid in the 70s. There were 2 years there. I didn't pay him. And what am I going to do? And he waited for a second and he looked and he said, yeah, you didn't pay us. You didn't file those 2 years, did you? And I said, no. And, he said, listen, you owe us. And he told me what amount it was, a few $1,000s. And he said, do you want to pay it back now? And I said, well, can I get on a plan? And he said, of course you can. I'm going to send you paperwork. How much can you pay a month? And I said, $100. And he said, when can you pay it by? And I said, the 15th. And he said, okay, I'm sending you paperwork that you'll sign that says you promised to pay us that amount on the 15th. And you will never hear from me again if that check gets here until that's paid off. You'll never hear from us again. And I said, okay. So I signed the papers and I sent him a check on the 15th every month. Never heard from Tony again, you know. And I made a list of the things I had to pay my mom. I owed her thousands of dollars. And I heard my friend Sharon C. talk about making amends to her dad, and her dad knew how much she owed him. And my mom, I don't think she had a firm number, but I knew I did. And I had several thousand dollars there to pay her back. And I made a chart I made on paper. Now, this is not on a computer. I just lined out with a ruler and pencil on paper the amount I owed her. And if I paid her, I'll pay her $20 a week, you know, for the next 2 years until I've paid it off. And I added interest to it also. And so my mom, and I sent her a card, because Sharon said that when she sent her dad money, she would send him a card and tell her what was going on in her life. And so I did the same thing. And so I sent the check every week, and I put a little card in it and said, this is what I did this week, and I'll see you this weekend, or I won't be seeing you this weekend, but we'll get together for dinner, da, 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 all that stuff. And what happened was, after the end of all of it, now, mind you, she never told me to stop. She was just surprised that I did it, but she never said, oh, you don't owe me any money, my darling child. She enjoyed getting the checks. But what we got after that was, we had a relationship after that because of the notes and because of the action taken to pay the money back. So whether it's the Internal Revenue Service or it's your mother or father, you can't go wrong by making a commitment and keeping it, which is what AA taught me, is that it's not about the money. It's not about the relationship. It's about making a promise and following through, which I never could do before. So there you have it.
Thank you. There's a question that's been submitted. Can you share some of your 11th step practice? Do you do any forms of meditation?
My 11th step practice is, I don't want to say sporadic. I don't have a regimented set of readings in the morning. When my feet hit the floor in the morning, I say, good morning, Father. Please let me do your will today. This is the prayer I learned when I was new. Please show me what your will is today and help me to do it for you. And I will do the best I can. And then throughout the day, I talk to God all day. Sometimes, you know, it sounds weird. We do a lot of driving in Los Angeles County, and I sit in my car and I'll see somebody walk across the street on the crosswalk, and I'll think, God, please be with that person today and let them know they're loved. Let them know they love them. That's all. I'm not ordering God to. I'm just saying, I'd love to have that person experience love, because I'll never know about it. But maybe somebody did the same thing for me one time and I didn't know about it. You know, maybe one time when I felt really overjoyed in my sobriety, that someone sitting at a light watching me cross the street said, I hope that guy has a great day. And so I think we're in this for each other to spiritually connect, because as I said, I don't like people generally. That's a theory, but I do care about people. I care about people terribly. And I pray for them all the time. And I don't pray for specifics. I just pray that the presence of their higher power will make itself known in their life. And in doing so, I feel like the presence is alive and conscious. It's a conscious contact. That's all they ask us to do. We make a conscious contact with this power. And I try to do that all day. I don't read a lot of spirit. I read spiritual books all the time, but I don't study them and have like a regular, I understand people have with their coffee and they read certain books each morning. I really admire that and respect that, but that's not my practice. So I guess that's the answer. That's my answer.
Thank you. And it's okay if you don't have an answer to this one. There's other questions, but do you have a favorite Clancy story you'd share?
Oh, geez. I think the one that I like the most, that I've told the most, is that he was at a Friday night meeting in the Valley, and a guy got up to take a cake. They gave the birthdays before this main speaker, before the coffee break. And he got up and he went on for about 15 minutes taking his cake, which when you get, when you take a cake, it's thank you, thank your sponsor, thank your higher power, and sit down. Really, nobody wants to hear your, you have nothing to say, really. And so he spoke for about 15 minutes. You know, he had about 12 years. He took a 12-year cake. And everybody's looking at Clancy because he was not the most tolerant guy when it came to that. But he just listened. And then the coffee break came, and then they announced him to speak, and he got up to the podium, and people that knew him, we were going, now he's gonna let it fly. Nothing. He went through his whole talk, and he got to the end, and he said, and if you do some simple actions around here, and you do them as part of your life, and you follow direction, you'll have a reaction to a higher, a relationship to a higher power, and you'll be able to have, you know, 13 years like Tom here. And the guy said, oh, it's 12, Clancy. And Clancy said, it was 12 when you started. And that just personified him, because he knew this guy would interrupt him. He knew the guy would correct him. And it was magnificent. So that's my favorite Clancy story.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I feel like I'm pressing my luck here, but how about Chuck Chamberlain? A lot of us didn't get to meet him. Do you have a Chuck C story?
No, my sponsor was sponsored by Chuck and was at the New Pair of Glasses retreat in 1975, I think it was when that. And so Bob tells me Chuck's story, but I didn't know Chuck well. He was a legend in AA at the time. And he died in 1984. And I was only 3 years sober, and I heard him talk a dozen times in that time, but I didn't learn to understand him until I was about 20 years sober, and I sort of got it. But at the time, everybody else seemed to be really enjoying him, and he was a nice man. I just don't have any real stories about him because I didn't know him.
And I get we're short of time, but I want to honor this question that came in. Could you elaborate the truth is in quotes. Could you elaborate on the truth you spoke of with respect to therapy being ineffective for alcoholism?
My alcoholism is, as I understand it, a disease of perception. That my perception of things is incorrect on any given time, at any given time. And for me to seek a solution based on my misperception of things is ridiculous. I have to go to somebody else. And that somebody else might tell me the truth of it that is way off from what I thought it was. They might say, You're not a victim here. You're being selfish. And I don't want somebody to tell me I'm selfish. You know, I get defensive about that, but I can't. In therapy works if you are willing to tell the truth about yourself. And I am surrounded by a scaffolding of misperceptions, little protective measures to protect my gentle inner spirit so I don't get bruised inside. And so therapy is not going to work on alcoholism. It might work on a lot of things, but it isn't going to work on alcoholism because I can't get to it when I'm new. I need alcoholics to help me with that. Therapy will help me with other people and how to deal with conflict and that stuff at that level. But I really need to know how to forgive. I need to know how to create a conversation with a power greater than I am. And I need how to learn how to be more open with my fellows here so I can take that out into the world and use it there. So that's what I got.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. This was amazing. You were so generous. And thank you, Charlie. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody who participated, Larry, for wrangling the questions, all of you for just taking the time to come here and be together tonight. Everybody will get the opportunity to thank Charlie one more time after we pray. You guys come back tomorrow night for Cleo D, and come back next Sunday for our dear Don Major. Same bat time, same bat channel. And BJ, Would you be willing to read the last three paragraphs on 164 if I post them?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Charlie. That was incredible. Appreciate it. My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, BJ.
This is from A Vision for You, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, BJ. All right, everybody is free to unmute. How about we virtually circle up and hold hands and have a moment of silence to do with as you wish. Feel free to unmute and we'll do the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven,
hallowed be
thy name.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,
the power, and the glory,
forever.
Amen.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Charlie.
That was amazing.
Good talk, Charlie.
Thank you.
Great, sir. Charlie.
Thanks for having us.
Charlie, thank you. Yes. Somebody's in trouble.
Yeah, really. I hope you all have a great week, and I'll see you somewhere down the road.
I hope so. I really do. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. If you see me in a store, introduce yourself. If I'm misbehaving, that'll get back on track. So, anyway, thanks, Dave, for having me.
Thank you so much. It really was a joy, Charlie. Thanks. Thank you again.
Great week. Take care.
You too. Oh, what a sweetheart.
That was great.